That's a composition called Peace Patrol. The composer, one of cinema's early and long-lived stars, Charlie Chaplin. Chaplin, who had one time dreamed of becoming a concert cellist and violinist, published Peace Patrol in 1916. Peace Patrol. Do you picture Chaplin winking at us? This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. We opened with Peace Patrol from Charlie Chaplin because in this portion of the program, we're going to talk about the birth of the motion picture. What was it like to be on the frontier of the movies? Here was a new technology, a new way of communicating. Our guest today is writer and editor Peter Koble. Koble and the Library of Congress have collaborated on a new illustrated history of the silent film. The title, Silent Movies, The Birth of Film and the Triumph of Movie Culture. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Peter Koble is the former managing editor of Premier Magazine, and he has written for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Entertainment Weekly. Silent Movies, The Birth of Film and the Triumph of Movie Culture is published by Little Brown. The book's foreword was written by filmmaker Martin Scorsese, and the introduction was written by film historian Kevin Brownlow. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Peter Koble, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Celeste, thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. What was your introduction to silent film? Do you remember the first one you saw?
It was probably a Buster Keaton film. I really can't remember.
Yeah.
I'm not a film scholar. I'm an arts and entertainment journalist, and I've written widely on contemporary films, but I've always loved classic films. And I was an English major, and I had a couple courses in history and art of the film where I saw, you know, the basic classic silent films, Metropolis and Intolerance. And as with anything, believe it or not, this book has been 5 years in the making.
I believe it.
I met with people from the Library of Congress, and I was lucky enough to be invited by them to work on this book, collaborate with them. And over the years, the succeeding years, and it seems like a long time, I've seen a lot of movies, silent movies, and I've learned a lot from the curators there who are, you know, deeply steeped in this subject and have been studying it, you know, for their lifetime. So that was a lucky opportunity for me.
Yeah.
But as with anything,
yeah,
that as you learn more about it, the more interesting it becomes. And so over the past few years, I've sort of become an evangelist for silent films.
Yeah. What was it like being immersed in the archive? This is at the Library of Congress, the world's largest film archive. What was it like being immersed in the archive and in making this book?
Well, as the famous Argentine writer Jorge Luis Borges once said, he imagined paradise to be a sort of library. And on my first tour of the film section of the library, which is more widely known for its book collections and photo collections and map collections and sound recordings. For some reason, its movie collection isn't as well known, and that was one of the library's purposes in putting together this book, to let people know not just about their collection, but their extremely important restoration work. That said, it was mind-boggling to me to walk in there and to see these pristine, you know, pristine without a crease, one-sheet movie posters of Chaplin or Metropolis, to go on a tour. And, of course, as with any public or even private institution that has an enormous collection, not everything is cataloged because, for whatever reason, you know, there are other priorities or there isn't funding. But if you go through with a curator, there are these drawers, and they just, you know, there's no card catalog or there's nothing online, but there's drawer, you know, 3A, and the curator pulls open the drawer, and there's a still from the 1910 original Frankenstein. It's and then this amazing collection of glass slides, which they used. They were usually colored and tinted, and they used when they were changing reels, if they only had one projector. And I was bowled over, what can I say?
Yeah.
It was, you know, like a peak experience for me the first time I went through.
Today, drawer 3A, tomorrow, drawer 3B.
Yeah. And who has the time?
Yeah.
But the curators know. It's amazing. They know how to find things. And we truly collaborated on this book, and we agreed that we would do, you know, as much as possible a survey of the world history of silent film. And I came up with an outline. We worked it out. And the text, I think, I hope, tells an interesting story about an art form which is really unique in that you see over a period of three decades its growth, you know, from birth to maturity. And by maturity, I mean the 20s and the 70s are my two favorite film decades.
Interesting.
And so many films of the 20s are just, you know, I would say, you know, among the greatest films ever made. Film really reached a peak, so it was a maturity. It would have been really far more interesting, you know, for me to have lived during that time and actually seen the growth firsthand. But studying it and, you know, going from 20-second films to full-length features was just fascinating for me to see, you know, the baby steps and then, you know, the growing confidence and then just the brilliance of the 20s.
We're talking about silent films this afternoon with journalist, writer, and editor Peter Koble. He and the Library of Congress have collaborated on a wonderful book, a visual history, along with a lot of information in copy about the silent era. The title of the book, Silent Movies, The Birth of Film and the Triumph of Movie Culture. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now. Someone waiting for us in Munster, Indiana, on line 4. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Celeste.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a couple of quick observations and comments for your guest, and I'll go ahead and ring off. Listening to you talk, I remember in college, oh, some 35 years ago, I took a class, Politics in the Film, and remember the importance of films like Birth of a Nation or Steps of Odessa, Potemkin, Mother, movies like that, just absolutely fascinating. However, I do remember getting a book on the history of silent movies, and I was interested to find out that actually in the very, very beginning, north side of Chicago, was one of the first studios for silent movies, and I'm guessing they had to move out west, obviously for climate purposes, but that was interesting. And remember seeing a postcard from 1908 for Hollywood, California, which was the sleepy little burg of orange groves, and of course what it's become. But also, too, I think back then the silent movies, I think maybe there were pennies to go see, and people were hard-pressed maybe to make a dollar, maybe $2 a week, and then the enormous amounts of money generated by these silent movies and the silent stars like Gish and Swanson and Charlie Chaplin, it was just boggles the mind how much money they were making, you know, some close to 100 years ago. So anyway, enjoying the show. There's a lot there. I'll leave it for your comments. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for the call. There is a lot there. Studios in Chicago, or a studio in Chicago?
Interesting comments. There were studios all over, and in a way, you know, the early days of the very, very early days of filmmaking were really wide open. And in writing my book, I tried both to evoke the culture of the times and what else was going on, and I tried to draw parallels between styles and subjects back then and with today. And one thing is, if this isn't too much of a stretch, it almost seems like the early days was so DIY, do it yourself, just get a camera and basically you were a studio, that it reminds me a little bit of the internet bubble back in the 90s when, you know, on a shoestring, you could start your own company. If you had a good idea, it would make it. If you didn't, you didn't. But it was that kind of, you know, excitement generated by this new technology, this new art form. There were, you know, it's... birth in America is really, you know, on the East Coast, but and they made studios out of glass houses so that they could have, you know, take full advantage of the sun, but be protected from the weather. But more and more, they started going out west to film during the winter, or they would go to Florida to film. And there was at one point. Very good chance that Florida might have become the Hollywood, but they chose California instead, just for the warmer climes. Yeah. In part because California, you know, around the LA area, there's the geography is more varied. You know, you have plains, mountains, and that people were getting pretty tired of. Genre that was really popular at the time, westerns, so-called New Jersey westerns, because, you know, the landscape was always the same, but California offered you know, myriad opportunities for different scenes.
Yeah. The caller also mentioned what it cost to go to a movie and the stars that you could go see, you know, and... sit there in the dark and marvel at these beautiful people. That gets me to the book's jacket, featuring a wonderful photo of Clara Bow.
Yes, I love that photo.
The It Girl.
We were down to a choice between her and Charlie Chaplin and Jackie Coogan, and I hope we made the right choice.
Because
it seems not only striking, but... more modern in a way.
Yeah. Well, it also speaks to one of the reasons we go to the movies, and that's for glamour and beauty, and that's why we celebrate the stars.
Yeah. Now, when people were going to Nickelodeons, so-called because you could get in for a nickel, that was the first Nickelodeon started in Pittsburgh in 1905, if memory serves, and then they started popping up like mushrooms. And it was a nickel, or sometimes it was a dime. And it was something that the, you know, even new immigrants or working class could afford. At that time, they were downplaying stars because producers quite sagely realized if they started promoting individual stars, those stars would want more money. And they played them down, and then they sort of played up their studio, if it was a quality studio. A lot of times people didn't care. But there were these Nickelodeons that were storefronts converted into a movie theater, packed to the gills, stuffed to the gills with people, watching one-reelers, and it's interesting. It became a kind of melting pot at that time for people.
Hmm.
New immigrants could even they could learn American mores, you know, how people should dress. They could even learn English. And in fact, at that point, even some films didn't have intertitles, so there would be a narrator in the Nickelodeon shouting out, or sometimes there would even be someone reading the intertitles for those who couldn't read English. And I have a very close friend whose Italian grandmother always told her that she learned English at the movies. The stars came a bit later and were often in big productions that, you know, might show in palatial movie theaters. You know, they started building really grand places. And then you could, you know, they'd be charging $1 or $2.
Mm.
There's something about silent film and actors. And I have to say that one of the extraordinary things about silent film and is that because it's quote-unquote unreal, it doesn't have the verisimilitude of modern films, you know, with spoken dialogue and, you know, crashing cars and all of that, and you're just pulled into it. Because of, you know, it's not real,
mm-hmm.
and there's this kind of distance, it's almost like a dream, and you're kind of drawn into this dreamscape,
mm-hmm.
and in a way, especially with superstars like Greta Garbo or Gloria Swanson, somehow that dreamscape makes you identify with these stars even more intensely
mm-hmm.
than stars today. Just a theory, and just I'm speaking from my personal experience, but it's a very pleasant place to be. And you sort of feel closer to them now.
Yeah.
Now, of course, because we have the tabloids and People magazine and all these places where you can see paparazzi photos of stars without makeup going grocery shopping, they're sort of brought down to a human level, whereas there was less of that in the 20s when all these great stars emerged. And so they were more remote and Olympian, you know, godlike. You just saw them on the screen.
Yeah. Well, Clara Bow here looks a little bit like a goddess, doesn't she?
She does indeed.
Oh, my goodness. This is circa 1925, and she's at a party. She's at a masquerade. And she looks, though, she looks a little sad, a little wistful, and she's turning to look behind her, and she's wearing a beautiful gown that doesn't have a back to it. She just looks gorgeous.
It's a beautiful photo.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
See if you think if this, what I'm about to say, is an accurate picture of an image carried forward. You mentioned the movie Metropolis.
Yeah.
So let's take the image of the a female robot
right.
created and carry it forward to Seven of Nine in the Star Trek series Voyager. I don't know if you are familiar with that, and right into a Heineken beer commercial that's playing now on a TV in your house. So,
okay.
Any comment there, and I'll hang up and listen.
Sure, that's an interesting question. How the images from the past keep showing up again and again.
Well, I mean, so many images from Metropolis are so iconic, and there are certain other films, as the previous person mentioned, Battleship Potemkin, the scene on the Odessa steps. There are certain things that our popular culture just kind of, is constantly hungry for imagery. And, you know, it's not at all surprising that some of this imagery, because the people in advertising are very smart, is regurgitated in different ways. In fact, in movies, the scene in Battleship Potemkin on the Odessa steps has been used, in a serious way or parodied so many times that the film critic, good film critic, Ebert once said, I seem to recall, that it was probably more likely that current filmgoers had seen some parody of that scene than that they had seen the original from Battleship Potemkin. And that's how things just keep repeating. And that's part of why I think, you know, it's so fascinating to go back and look at these films, because you can see their influence. To give another example, the technique of montage that the Russian silent filmmakers loved, where you're intercutting different images, different scenes, that you have to make kind of an intellectual leap to connect, and they fly by, is used today. Now, it's not as common, but one famous filmmaker, Coppola, has used it many times, and one really great example, I think, is in Apocalypse Now,
mm-hmm.
where at the very end, Colonel Kurtz, Marlon Brando, of course, is being assassinated, and that is being intercut with the ritual sacrifice by some tribal people of a water buffalo. And that, you know, he's gotten that from studying Russian silent films.
Yeah,
effective and incredible, but it's kind of more interesting if you know where that comes from.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Like our first caller, my first real encounter with silent films was in school, where I saw The Battleship Potemkin, and
uh-huh.
I saw Mother.
Yeah.
It is a wonderful thing to have the opportunity to see these films, because it makes you a much better film goer. And I'm thinking, again, you mentioned the intercutting, you know, that back and forth kind of thing. That also shows up in The Godfather.
Yes, it does. Good point.
Yeah.
Very much so at the end.
Yeah. One of my, and here I'm going to do a caveat here. One of my favorite films,
uh-huh.
and silent films, and I say I have this caveat about it because I haven't seen many of them, and that's that makes me sad, and your book makes me want to see them. But
I'm glad of that.
The Passion of Joan of Arc,
uh-huh.
1928,
uh-huh.
Carl Dreyer. I had the great pleasure of seeing that in a theater I've got it here. Let me make a reach here. Richard Einhorn's oratorio that
yes.
he wrote for this film, performed by the Anonymous Four.
Oh, my gosh.
It was unbelievable.
That I'm sure it was.
The theater was enraptured. It was one of the most amazing theater experiences I've ever had in my life. And we left that theater, and people, it was, you know, I could imagine myself seeing that film, you know, having somewhat of that experience of 1928, the power of it.
Yes. Not only is that, I think, one of the most beautiful films ever made, and just the iconography of the faces and just the crispness of the photography, it is, you know, startling. And the faces just haunt you. But Einhorn's oratorio is brilliant, and I, you know, have put on the DVD I have of The Passion of Joan of Arc and just, you know, turned on the sound and listened to that over and over again. But your opportunity to hear it live with The Anonymous Four, one of my favorites, I envy you.
Yeah, it was marvelous. And thinking it once again back to Carl Dreyer, the choices he made in telling the story of Joan of Arc. I mean, Joan of Arc has been a story that's been told over and over and over and over again. But he chose to tell it in a way that it is absolutely timeless, and it is a story of heroine and yet of persecution. So,
interestingly, there was at just about the same time a French epic made on Joan of Arc, which was really successful, but it was the sort of Joan of Arc story that we would tell today. You know, an epic drama with lots of battle scenes and, you know, an epic scope. And for your listeners who aren't familiar with the Passion of Joan of Arc, it's all about her trial, and it actually uses the transcript of the trial. And it's very intimate. It's almost like some kind of intimate epic of what she goes through, and you can see the cruelty in the judges' faces. You can see her despair. It's communicated without words. The words are unnecessary,
mm-hmm.
really.
Now, this brings me to want to talk with you about a fellow by the name of Abel Gance, if I'm pronouncing his name right. This was somebody new to me. But The Passion of Joan of Arc was made at the same studio, at the same French studio where Abel Gance worked.
Right.
And you call him the giant of French silent cinema. Tell us about him.
Well, you know, not only, he also used a kind of rapid montage technique that kind of, in a way, this rapid cutting can bring another level of depth of, you know, psychological insight into characters. His great film, which Kevin Brownlow, who was kind enough to write the introduction to my book, has been restoring for decades, and he keeps finding new pieces to add. If Gance had only done Napoleon, this epic about Napoleon, he would be, you know, a star in the history of cinema forever. It's such a staggeringly engrossing film. It's an epic, and the best epics, and I'm a huge fan of epics from the silent era, and I, you know, include Metropolis with that, and Ben-Hur, and Napoleon is so wonderful. They mix the, you know, grandeur of battle scenes and, you know, the struggles between nations with these intimate portraits of individuals who are making a difference and changing history. And that's what he was able to do. I mean, he really makes Napoleon a living figure. Follows him from school, in which there's this famous sequence where there's a snowball fight at school, and the young Napoleon really treats it as kind of a war. The kids have taken sides, and he has, and they've got fortifications with snow, and he comes up with this strategy, a brilliant kind of war strategy, and wins the snowball fight. And you see, you know, the beginning of genius. And it's that kind of combination of the grandeur of the photography with the intimacy of the psychological portraits that makes Gantz such a wonderful filmmaker.
Yeah.
And like I said, Kevin Brownlow's become obsessed with this film, and you know, I can't blame him. If that was all Kevin Brownlow had done, you know, restoring this movie, you know, he'd be remembered and as a great film person. But he's done so many other great books on silent film history.
It's fun reading the story of how he got caught up in film and silent film in particular.
I love his introduction, and it's kind of an intimate story that he hasn't told before. You know, usually in The Parade's Gone By, this classic book where he just interviews all these people. He was lucky enough to be around in time to interview a lot of really famous stars and directors and cinematographers, and he just basically lets them talk and just quotes page after page of them talking. And it's nice, it's interesting to hear his experiences, you know, and how he became a silent film lover.
Yeah. In 1964, he left Britain and flew over to the United States, and he went to Hollywood, and he just apparently just picked up the phone.
Yeah. Yeah. That's...
And started talking with, he talked with Buster Keaton. He writes in his essay, he talked with as many people he could in 10 days, Buster Keaton to Gloria Swanson.
Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty courageous thing to do, basically.
Yeah. In 1964, though, you wonder, though, if those folks from the silent era were eager to talk and get some stories out there and have someone interested and have them write them down or record them. So,
I think they probably were thrilled to do it, and that comes across in The Parade Comes By, because, you know, there's an enthusiasm for remembering all of the crazy things that happened on sets, and you know, the way they had this vision, and maybe the technology wasn't there, but they would find ways to realize the director's vision, and that really comes across.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that reading over this stuff, I hope that my enthusiasm for the subject at least comes through a little bit. I mean,
I think it does. I think it does. I don't think you have to worry about that.
Thank you.
Speaking of epics, you like the epic. Well, and this brings us to another filmmaker, and a controversial one. And the film I'm thinking of is Intolerance. And an interesting title from a man who has been excoriated for intolerance, and that's D.W. Griffith.
Right.
There's a still in the book from this film. What a stunner it must be. Now, does this film exist? Has it been preserved?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah. It's a film classic. It's available on DVD. I think it's brilliant. A lot of people have kind of sniped at it because, for one thing, they say it's not really about intolerance, and it's not really four different stories going on simultaneously. Some of the stories, you know, aren't very well developed, like the crucifixion of Christ. There are only a few scenes of that. And on the other hand, if you see the if you see photos, either stills or pictures of the set, and the set was left standing in Hollywood for quite some time until, and there are pictures of the ruins of the set. You know, it just started, became very dilapidated, and according to the Los Angeles Fire Department, a fire hazard, and they demanded that it finally be torn down, but it was just standing there for quite a while after Griffith filmed that. Now, he did that, some say, in a way to make up for Birth of a Nation, which I have to say is was hard for me to go back and watch because parts of it are so blatantly racist. Mm-hmm. It just made me terribly uncomfortable, and I avoided watching it for a while. I knew I had to, of course, but intolerance, my take on it is Griffith was exploring a new medium. He didn't know how powerful the imagery would be in a film that big. I'm talking about Birth of a Nation now. And I don't think deep down he was a racist. He was using a very popular, there was a very popular play, immensely popular play, based on Dixon the Klansman. And actually the movie is based on a couple of books by Dixon. And if you look at those books are, you know, horrifyingly racist. Now, he did choose a subject matter, you know, that was potentially inflammatory and was, although on the happy side of it, there were a lot of demonstrations, and it helped to build up the NAACP as an organization in reaction to this movie. That's a positive thing. There was also, you know, a recrudescence of Klan activity, very unhappy side of that. But in many other films, Griffith shows a lot of sensitivity on the subject of race. It's just, and I'm not going to make excuses for him or make a call because I don't know whether he was, you know, a racist or not. I just, and the film is racist. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. And I can see how it makes a lot of people very, very uncomfortable. Yeah. But I don't think that's the whole story on Griffith. And part of the tragedy of the whole history of American cinema is the first great American epic, The Birth of a Nation, was a deeply racist film. Hmm.
What does it take to achieve a great film? Did any of the filmmakers of this era put down or talk with someone about their vision, about the elements of a great film?
Well, they all talked a lot, and there's an enormous variety. And as I note, you know, most of the current film genres were born during that time. And even in my chapter on genres, I can't really even discuss all of them. There wasn't room, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But there are great films of all kinds, as we know. I mean, there's a great epic, and part of the, I think the great epic directors knew that you couldn't just have battle scenes, that you had to have scenes, more intimate scenes, where people could identify with the major characters and care about them. They just didn't want to see battle scenes. And there's one of my favorite movies from this period is The Crowd by King Vidor. And it's not one that's necessarily on the average filmgoer's radar, who might know, you know, something about Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, Battleship Potemkin, people like that. The Crowd is about a guy who works as a clerk in a giant company in New York City in the 20s, and he's kind of like every man, and he has a wife and a couple kids, and he aspires to something else, you know, something better. He wants to write advertising, if, you know, we might laugh at that, but, you know, he wants to do something more creative with his life. And it's just a very simple, realistic drama of life, and it takes place in, you know, 1920s New York, and they put a camera and a vegetable cart and went down the sidewalks of New York, and you see these people, racing to work or racing home, and, you know, except for the clothes, it's not that different here in New York now. Mm. And this everyman story is so touching and moving, you just have to tell yourself, my God, this is life. And, you know, we think of genre films, when we think of silent films, like slapstick or, you know, some of the big epics like Ben-Hur or Metropolis. But there were these great melodramas, or dramas, I would call them, that were, you know, moving and modern and nothing the least bit antiquated about them. Yeah. And they knew what they were doing. That's what comes across. I don't know if this is answering your question, but they figured it out.
Yeah.
They figured out how to tell stories and you know, make them compelling.
Yeah. Well, speaking of an everyman, that's Charlie Chaplin's The Tramp.
Yes, indeed. He could play so many different characters, you know, odd characters, with that same costume and evoke them. He was such a chameleon. And I sort of came into the world of silent film from the drama side, and was a latecomer to comedy, and at first, you know, I fell in love with Keaton, who has this drier sense of humor,
mm-hmm.
And he's more deadpan, which, you know, like, is somehow more appealing to me, and I resisted Chaplin for a while until I really dug into it, especially like this period where he was doing Two Reelers, which I think was, he did some of his best work. And, you know, what I thought was a tendency to be a little bit sentimental, I just began to see so much more emotional depth there. And his remarkable acting ability, the chameleon everyman quality that he could evoke, yeah, is just extraordinary.
Well, clearly both of them are great. Keaton,
yeah, they're the they're giants.
Yeah.
I quote Woody Allen in an interview that he did with The New Yorker, and he pretty much acknowledges them as the two giants of comedy of all time. And, you know, a tip of the hat from him is saying something.
You used the word modern a moment ago, a couple of times, and I thought maybe what we would do here is we'd wrap up with another composition from Charlie Chaplin.
Great.
One of his best known, probably, Smile. And this he wrote as the main theme for Modern Times. And so this was, you know, in this was a picture with a soundtrack. But anyway, I wanted to wrap up here with Chaplin's Smile. So let's
That's
do
great.
That. And Peter, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's been a pleasure.
Peter Koble, he and the Library of Congress have collaborated on the book Silent Movies, The Birth of Film and the Triumph of Movie Culture. Thank you.